Critics now call charter schools an invasive species. A film recalls the world's most revered Holocaust witness, and Argentines vote with Americans watching closely. Welcome to the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm your host, Tim Padgett. In the next hour, we'll try to understand why and how charter schools can literally move into public schools like South Florida's and enjoy public school resources for free. Is this the death knell for public education? We'll also talk to the son of the late Holocaust survivor and Nobel Peace Laureate, Elie Wiesel, about the new documentary of his life, Soul on Fire. And we'll ask why this Sunday's midterm elections in Argentina matter so much here in America. All that coming up right after the news. I'm Tim Padgett. Welcome to the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. Bienvenidos, bienveni, bienvindo. We're used to the idea of invasive species here, Burmese pythons, Brazilian pepper trees, but public education advocates now say they've identified another, those publicly funded but privately organized institutions called charter schools. Under Florida's new Schools of Hope program, charter schools can co-locate at any public school the state approves for the move-in. And that's just what charter schools can do. Move in, if not take over, a public school, gaining all but free access to its resources. Supporters of this arrangement, including Republican Florida Governor Ron DeSantis, say it offers all students more educational opportunities, especially in struggling districts. Critics call it a parasitic invasion of public school space that threatens to suck the lifeblood out of public education itself, which they claim, and which proponents like DeSantis deny, is the end game of initiatives like this, right alongside other recent Florida measures, such as giving even rich families vouchers for private schools. We'd like to hear your thoughts about the Schools of Hope project and how it stands to affect South Florida public education. Call us at 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. Joining me now to help us better understand the rationale for and the response to this controversial new schools initiative is Scott Travis. He's the veteran education reporter for the South Florida Sun Sentinel. Scott, great to have you back on the South Florida Roundup.
Hey, Tim. Good to be here.
And with me here in the studio is Crystal Etienne. She's president of the nonprofit EduVoter Action Network here in Miami. Crystal, thanks for coming in.
Thank you for having me, and thank you for having this discussion.
Scott Travis, can we start here by just reminding folks what exactly was the state legislation that produced this Schools of Hope program? What was the idea behind it, and how does it work?
Okay, yeah. So it started in 2017, and it was originally created as a lifeline for kids that were stuck in D and F schools. So the original legislation allowed a school to open within a school's boundaries if a school was D or F rated for multiple years. And mm-hmm. I think it could be like a 5-mile radius from that school or that school's
boundary.
Okay,
that's good context, because I think a lot of people think that just somehow started this year. And that, so thanks for reminding
right.
me.
So, yeah. Right. So what happened over the years, it has dramatically expanded. And not all the changes happened this year, but the end effect, what we have now, is that the definition of a low performing school has changed so that it's no longer D or F schools. There are A schools that are on that list now.
Right.
And also they made it easier where there are other criteria, including if you are in a federally recognized opportunity zone, that you can go in there. And basically, if you listen to the discussion from the legislature this year, really what it kind of morphed into was a focus on schools that were low enrolled. So there's been a lot of empty space in Florida schools. And part of that is because of changes that have been made by the state, including the voucher expansion.
Right.
But also there's been some population loss as well.
That's a particularly prominent issue where you are in Broward, right?
Correct.
Yeah. But just really quickly, Scott, how does this work? How does a charter school move into an existing public school in the way that this program lays out?
So basically, they take a look at a list of schools that have space, And they have to have a reason to choose that. And presumably it's because they're going to be serving a low performing students at a low performing school nearby, but that's not always the case. Mm-hmm. But they say how many seats that they want to locate in that particular school. And Matter Academy, which sent 27 letters to Broward County, basically picked every available seat that was in those 27 schools, and it came out to be about 18,000 students that they're asking to
and
serve.
And I want to get to that with you in just a second. But Scott, also lay out for us then, if you can please, why folks like Governor DeSantis support this charter schools installed in public school setup, and why they believe it means expanded educational opportunities for Florida students. And then on the other side, why folks like our other guest here today, Crystal Etienne, who we're going to hear from in just a second, why they oppose this arrangement and why they believe it could potentially wreck public education.
Okay, well, supporters, initially they said, and there's still this argument today, is that there's a lot of kids stuck in failing schools or schools that are not performing as well as they should. There's no DRF schools left in Broward anymore, but there are still some C schools. But there are kids that are in schools that the parents are not happy. So the proponents of this argue that this gives an opportunity. And the reason why they see it as an advantage to put it on existing school campuses is because there are so many schools that have empty space. And they argue that taxpayers built these schools. All of the space is just going unused. So what better use for this empty space than to put a school? So that would be what the proponents
argue. To put a charter school, which they feel has perhaps a more varied curriculum that the students in the public school could then benefit from. Is that a correct assessment?
Right. Yeah. Okay. But it would offer something different than what's being offered by public schools.
And the critics then, on the other hand, are saying what, essentially?
The critics are saying that, you know, this is a way to destroy public education, and that they're also changing the rules to really hurt public schools. That this was designed when you had a public school that was truly failing, but that's not really the case anymore. Right now, what you've got is these charter schools are finding provisions in the law that may allow them to go into A-rated schools that are not failing. So what students are they serving? And it's possible that you could be allegedly serving students in a low-performing school by opening a school that's 20 miles away, and they argue, is that really serving those students?
Right. That brings us to you then, Crystal Etienne. In an op-ed you wrote this month for Florida Politics on the Schools of Hope situation, you start by asserting, quote, "Florida calls it choice. In reality, it's a rigged game in which billionaires, political insiders, and private operators win, while traditional public schools and taxpayers lose." Explain what you meant by that, please, Crystal.
Well, what I mean by that is simply no one asked them to come. You haven't seen a huge outcry for parents and families saying, please come and save our children. Why? Because, like Scott referred, there are no failing DNF schools anymore. But who did ask them to come was the billionaires and the millionaires that are funding the politicians and those that are trying to privatize public education.
So you feel they created a problem that only they could provide the answer for?
Correct.
Yeah. Okay. And I'm sorry, go ahead.
I didn't mean to interrupt. And with that, I mean, when they say that they offer a curriculum that the public schools don't offer, I mean, in Miami-Dade County alone, there's over 1,000 choice programs in MDCPS, Miami-Dade Public Schools. Mm-hmm. So what could they possibly offer that Miami-Dade Public Schools isn't already offering?
Mm-hmm. Can you give me an example of a good choice program, for example?
So they have DASH as a program, Turner Tech as a program that has medical. I mean, there's... Mm-hmm. There's magnet schools, there's IB, AB, ACE. Right. The list goes on and on.
Mm-hmm. Okay. But, Crystal, in your op-ed, you focus more specifically then on how this Schools of Hope controversy is playing out here in the Miami-Dade public school system with a charter school company called Success Academy that is poised to open campuses in Miami. Walk us through how you see this as an example of charter school integration compromising public schools.
It compromises public schools because, one, when they come in to co-locate, there's no guarantee that the students in that community get to go to that charter school. That's the thing about a charter school. They get to select their students. And oftentimes that's why they claim to do better, but the data shows they don't.
So if I'm in a failing school as a kid, there's no guarantee that if that charter school moves in, that I can avail myself of those educational opportunities the charter school is supposedly bringing in?
Correct.
Huh. Okay. And how many campuses, I mean, Success Academy then is, tell us about how they're, you know, poised to expand into Miami-Dade County.
Well, first of all, the reason they're poised to expand into Miami-Dade County is because in New York, they've reached their cap for charter schools in New York City and New York State.
And where is Success based?
It's based out of New York
City. Out of New York, okay. Mm-hmm. All right.
And so to come here, they wish to co-locate. And when they do that, they're asking to go into the school rent-free per the co-location law. Mm-hmm. The district school is going to have to fund the maintenance, the nursing, the upkeep, the food, everything that goes along with it. But yet they would be getting the same amount of money per student that the district school is getting. So they're actually enriching themselves and depleting what the district has to offer. In addition to that, they've requested, according to reports and resources, an additional $5,000 per student. And that's what I've said in many times now. What could you imagine what we could do with an extra $5,000 per student? Yeah. And where did that money come from that we have now to give it?
Scott Travis, you wrote this month in the Sun Sentinel, as we mentioned earlier, about another potential Schools of Hope dispute in Broward County involving 27 public schools where another charter school operator, Matter, as you just mentioned, wants to open campuses. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so Matter had sent letters to the school district earlier this month, about 2 weeks after the State Board of Education approved the rule asking for space in all of these schools. Some of the schools were a bit of a head scratcher because they included the technical centers like Atlantic Technical and McFadder, which are A-rated. And also, according to the district's estimates, they don't have space for any more students.
Huh.
Now, a state list showed that they do have space. The difference may have to do with the fact that they also serve adult students, too. So it's not clear whether the state list included all of the available space that they had.
Right.
But the district responded that it's too early for them to make the request. The rule has not actually gone into effect. It goes into effect sometime in November.
All right.
They basically said to come back to us after the rule.
So this is a stay tuned situation then. This is the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tim Padgett. I'm speaking with Scott Travis of the South Florida Sun Sentinel and Crystal Etienne of EduVoter Action Network about Florida's controversial new Schools of Hope initiative and why critics fear its coddling of charter schools means the throttling of public schools. Call us at 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. Crystal Etienne, another point you make in your Florida Politics op-ed is that while the Schools of Hope program is meant as a tool for helping improve failing schools and school districts, Miami-Dade Public Schools are hardly a failing system today, and yet you argue the state is still imposing charter schools into public schools here, as you and Scott have already mentioned. What do you feel is going wrong with the program in that regard?
Well, what's going wrong with the program is state overreach into local control.
Mm-hmm.
And we were awarded the Excellence Award, again, for only 13 districts in the state were given that award. So we're clearly not a failing district. We've been an A-rated district for many years now.
Mm-hmm.
So it's absurd to think that we need some sort of help. We have, even in the lowest impoverished communities, we have double and triple A rated schools. We have schools that have made learning gains year after year. We have schools that are on this list that received awards for making those gains. And now we're going to tell those students and those teachers that they're the ones that are failing. And that's just not right.
All right. Scott Travis, the other issue that keeps coming up is the claim that these charter schools are actually filling up, quote, underutilized space, as we've mentioned, and resources in these public schools. Let me play a clip here from Governor DeSantis this week speaking in Sarasota in response to criticism of the Schools of Hope process.
And so being able to provide operators some existing infrastructure that's not being utilized, you know, makes economic sense, but it also helps attract folks to come in and do it. So I understand, you know, why they're saying that. I don't think ultimately the critique is valid. And I think it's going to make a real difference. So they're starting in Miami, but their goal is to go to as many spots around Florida as they can.
Scott, what's your sense of how public school administrators like Broward County's are how they're responding to this claim by the governor and other schools of hope supporters that these charter schools are just filling a vast, quote, underutilized public school void, which, as you just pointed out in the case of Matter, for example, isn't always the case?
Yeah, they have been, the school district has been taking steps to try to fill some of the vacant space that it has, perhaps not as fast as people think they should. But they have been in discussions of closing schools and moving office space into existing school buildings. And they have some plans to do that. It's not clear whether the schools will be able to take all of the seats that are on the books now as being available, because this doesn't go in, their request is not until 2027.
Yeah, but
so the school district may not have that much.
I'm glad you pointed it out, because there would seem to be a conflict if Broward County, for its own fiscal health, is saying we want to close this school or that school, but yet a charter school is saying no, we want to avail ourselves of that space. Who wins out in the end?
I guess it depends on what they do with it. If they just close it and don't do anything with it, the charter school could probably move in because it would be a surplus property. If the school district finds another use for it, such as it rents it out to a community agency or it uses it as office space and there's no space available, then I guess the charter school can't move in.
Okay. Crystal Etienne, speaking of Sarasota, a coalition of public schools parents over there also wrote an op-ed in Florida Politics criticizing the Schools of Hope program. Its headline warned that this process, quote, is out of control and that it could, quote, dismantle local public schools piece by piece. Why do critics like them and your organization believe this is, in the end, a measure like universal private school vouchers to carry out the elimination of public education in Florida?
Well, it's interesting that you mentioned Sarasota and that the governor spoke from Sarasota. Mm-hmm. Sarasota has zero low-performing schools. And in fact, they're one of the best districts in the state. So why would we want a charter school to go in that has no proven record of doing any better than a public school? And they're going in for free. So again, taking away the resources from the district to accommodate a for-profit company. They always like to say that they're nonprofit public schools, but that's not true. They are ran by for-profit company education management organizations. Mm-hmm. And so that is the problem. They are trying to privatize public education, and the families in Sarasota see the danger, and they're trying to help the rest of the state see what's happening.
Finally then, Scott Travis, do you get the sense amid all the uproar from the public education community here and around the state that the Florida legislature in its upcoming session might, let's say, try to tweak or fine-tune some of these concerns about schools of hope?
I think that remains to be seen. What we may see in the next few weeks is that these charter school companies are trying to open in just about every school campus in Florida. If they try to do that, it may be sort of like the book challenges, where it seems like it's getting out of control. So maybe there needs to be some rules to rein it in a little bit. But we don't know that yet, right? We're going to have to see how many schools plan to open. There's a lot of feeling that even though Matter has asked for, I think, 60,000 seats at least throughout the state of Florida, they probably would not have the capacity to actually open that many, that they may just be trying to keep other providers from going into those same schools, because the state education rule says that it's first come, first serve.
Right.
So we'll have to see how this plays out. I think it's still too soon to tell.
We very much will. Scott Travis is the education reporter at the South Florida Sun Sentinel. Crystal Etienne is president of EduVoter Action Network. Many thanks to you both.
All right. Thanks, Tim.
Thank you.
Still to come, we talk to the son of Elie Wiesel about a new documentary of the Holocaust writer's Nobel-winning life. This is the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. Welcome back to the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tim Padgett. Chances are your high school or college reading experience included the powerful memoir by Holocaust survivor Elie Wiesel titled simply Night. Published in 1958, its spare but searing narrative made Wiesel one of the world's foremost spokespersons for Holocaust remembrance, work that later earned him the Nobel Peace Prize in 1986. His humane example is especially relevant today, almost a decade after his death, when anti-Semitism is again rearing its head around the U.S. and the world. Which is why it's especially fortunate to have a new documentary about Wiesel's life being released next week, including in South Florida. It's titled Elie Wiesel, Soul on Fire. Here's a trenchant clip of Wiesel's voice from the film.
What have I learned in the last 40 years? I learned the perils of language and those of silence. But I've also learned that suffering confers no privileges. This is why survivors have tried to teach their contemporaries how to invent hope in a world that offers none.
Do you have any thoughts to share about the life and work of Elie Wiesel? Call us at 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. We are privileged now to have with us Elie Wiesel's son, Elisha Wiesel, to tell us more about the documentary Soul on Fire and about his father. Elisha Wiesel, thank you very much for joining us.
And it's a pleasure to be on the show. Thank you.
Can you tell us how this documentary project came about first? What were its origins?
Sure. So you have to realize that even during my father's life, many producers had approached him asking to turn Night into a film. And my father had a very clear message for all of them, which was no. And the reason why was he never wanted any creative to get in between him and his audience.
Right.
He wanted his words to be read by his readers, and that was it. Now, after he passed, my mother and I both felt quite strongly that his voice was going to continue to be needed. And how could we bring it to a new generation that maybe wasn't encountering the book, bring in some new minds? And we did feel that his life story did justify there being a film. And we went on a hunt to find a producer and director who we thought would be the right fit.
And why the title of the documentary Soul on Fire?
My father released a book in the 1960s, actually late 60s, early 70s, called Souls on Fire, which was an exploration of Hasidic Judaism. What had happened with all of these rabbis in the 19th century who had broken from the synagogue as a major orientation point, believed in inner inquiry. They had really turned more to the concept of a personal relationship with God. They wanted something that was maybe a little less structured, right, more accessible to the person who didn't have the full suite of education that a lot of others in Eastern European might have had.
As I mentioned earlier, of course, your father, who was born in Romania, was best known for his iconic Holocaust memoir, Night, which recounts his and his family's horrific ordeal in the Auschwitz and then Buchenwald concentration camps. I still have the edition of Night that I read in college more than 40 years ago. I'm holding it in my hand right now as we speak. But my 20th century generation was obviously more closely connected time-wise to what Elie Wiesel was writing and warning the world about. Is this documentary in large part an effort to bring not just his story, but his message to a younger 21st century generation? And if so, why is that so important?
So as I think you're referring to, so many of my father's messages were beyond simply what he explored in terms of Holocaust education. And, you know, Night is a memoir about what happened to him during the Holocaust. My father developed a political identity in the 1960s when he went to go visit the Soviet Union, came back and reported on what he saw there. That book became The Jews of Silence. Mm-hmm. And although it was a very long, you know, it was a decade, multiple decades long arc with him and other Jewish leaders in the United States, that was really the beginning of awakening of, I think, of a political identity for American Jews, that we had a role to play in making a difference. We had brothers and sisters trapped by the Soviet Union, and Jews of Silence was a launching point in many ways for that movement. So it's incredibly important, I think, at this moment in time, when you look at the fractures in our country, you look at the fractures even within American Jewry, it's a very important time for us to be able to get together and find things that we believe in and work on them together. And you see that passion in this film about my father.
Alicia, what to your mind, though, is the most important thing Soul on Fire conveys to today's audience about what your father witnessed and suffered in those Holocaust ghettos and camps?
I think the most important thing to take away from the film is the power of choice and the power of choice that one person can make. My father suffered the most indescribable evil, and he could have come out of that defeated. He could have come out of that bitter. He could have come out of that and said, you know what, I'm not going to have children. And that's actually where he started that journey post-war. But my father made a choice, a series of choices. He made a choice that he was going to continue a relationship with God. He made a decision that he was going to continue living and eating and drinking and reading and being part of society. He made a decision that he was going to continue the Jewish people, not only by having a child, but by raising me, him, Jewish, and continuing this people that he'd been part of for so long. And last but not least, he decided that he had a responsibility, given all that he had been through, to do whatever he could to make the world a better place for that child over whose existence he was so concerned.
You mentioned about him becoming a father. One of the points the documentary makes about your father's life is that he never imagined himself having a family in the wake of this experience in the Holocaust, but he did. You were born in 1972 when he was in his 40s. And I go back to that aching passage of Night that affected me most when I first read it, when your father describes his own father's death in Buchenwald and the void it left in his soul. He writes in Night, "I could not weep. I had no more tears." How do you think that reality made him then a better father himself? How did becoming a father fill that void, do you think, speaking as his son?
Listen, it was a spiritual decision as much as a parental decision. The reason my father didn't want to have children was he believed the world did not deserve any more Jewish children. Let that just sit for a minute. What an incredible point to have gotten to after all of his suffering. And I think that the choice that he made to actually stand up for life, that was reflected in every subsequent decision he made with regards to how he raised me. My father obviously took me to places when other kids my age were going to Palm Beach or the Hamptons or wherever they were going. I was going to Auschwitz to visit camps. So I knew that life was different. But my father actually made, to the extent that he could, every effort to protect me from that until I was much older. He really didn't sit down and say, I need to tell you about the Holocaust. It was me that had to ask questions before he would tell me about it.
This is the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tim Padgett. I'm speaking with Elisha Wiesel, the son of the late Holocaust remembrance figure and Nobel laureate, Elie Wiesel, about the new documentary, Elie Wiesel, Soul on Fire. Call us at 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. And a reminder that if you miss any part of the program, you can search for the South Florida Roundup podcast in the NPR app or wherever you listen to podcasts. Alicia, we just talked about Elie Wiesel as your father, but we also have to mention that one of the things the documentary brings out is the importance of your mother, Marion Wiesel, herself a Holocaust survivor, who sadly died earlier this year, and our condolences to you and your family.
Thank you.
She herself was an important, an important Holocaust remembrance figure. Can you tell us a little more about her?
Of course. My mother was born in Vienna, and she remembered in 1938 standing on a street corner with her father watching the Nazis march in and getting the sense that things were about to go very wrong. She fled with her family across Europe, was interned by the French in a holding camp, really a concentration camp, where all of the inhabitants were subsequently sent to Auschwitz. She was lucky enough with her family to escape. They hid for a while in Marseille, ultimately made it to safety in Basel, and then she came to the United States. And I think what really is interesting about my mother, in particular, her connection to Florida, my mother newly arrived in the New York area in the 1950s, she became obsessed with coming down to the South almost every free weekend she had with her newly acquired NAACP card and participating in the social justice movement. She would come with a Black American friend of hers, and the two of them would try to get hotel rooms and get kicked out, and they would dutifully note each one and keep going and circulate back. So she was an activist from the very beginning because having been what she'd been through in Europe, she was floored at the idea that racism could exist in the United States and was very dedicated to fighting it.
No, that's fascinating to know. So as we also mentioned earlier, your father, Elie Wiesel, was known not just for his powerful Holocaust memoir, Night, but for the humanitarian work he did for the rest of his life, work that won him the Nobel Prize in 1986. What do you feel is the most important thing or things the documentary highlights about his transcendent post-Holocaust life and efforts?
You know, it's a documentary that's, you know, maybe an hour and a half in total length, so it's hard to get to everything. The Soviet Jewry movement that I mentioned, which I think was really my father's turning point as a political activist, really does not get mentioned very much in the film. What does get mentioned is a pivotal moment where my father confronts President Reagan, who is someone that he had a warm relationship with, and he confronts him in the White House over the decision that had been made by President Reagan's staff. In the interests of moving past the Cold War, he goes to Germany, President Reagan. He's scheduled to attend a cemetery event where there are SS soldiers buried there. And my father is being honored with the Congressional Medal of Honor. He shows up and challenges President Reagan on national TV to change his mind, to take a moral action, to do something different. And that really is a moment that the film appropriately dwells on with some footage that I had not seen before that I was very glad to see.
Now, your father died in 2016, and of course, even then, the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, for example, was raging. But a lot of people feel what we've witnessed in the past couple of years could have used Elie Wiesel's influence as a builder of understanding between people of different faiths and races and nationalities. As I mentioned at the outset, one of the ugly byproducts of the current Gaza war is not just the reemergence of anti-Semitism here and around the world, but is of Islamophobia as well. What lessons about your father's life and work does this documentary offer that we can use to diffuse the hatred we're seeing today, do you think?
The film doesn't really go deep into Israel-Palestine, and hopefully future works will be able to tackle this more properly. But I'll point you at really two different aspects of what my father did. I think it's much easier to talk about actual decisions that my father made while he was alive. Number one, my father always stood with the people of Israel. He felt that he had 6 million brothers and sisters over in Israel. They were his Jewish brothers and sisters. And he had their back. He knew how hard it was to run a country. He understood the military and security situation. He understood they needed a voice abroad, and that in the same way that anti-Semitism has existed against Jewish individuals for countless millennia, it was going to exist against the Jewish state, surrounded by many other Muslim states, many of whom sadly sought its destruction. So the first thing to know is my father always stood solidly with the state of Israel, no matter what it did. Second thing to note, though, is my father was interested in peace when the conditions were correct. So when Ehud Olmert was in office and it seemed like there might be a possibility to restart talks with the Palestinian Authority, my father and King Abdullah of Jordan hosted a conference in Petra, which brought together Mahmoud Abbas and Ehud Olmert to have really a beginning set of conversations. And the lesson for me in that is you have to remember Mahmoud Abbas, his PhD dissertation was on how the Holocaust was exaggerated. So imagine what it took for my father to sit there and smile and shake his hand and have a civil conversation. Yeah. Sometimes that's what you have to do in the interest of looking forward rather than backwards. So I give you both sides of that coin. My father is a firm and unyielding, unrepentant Zionist. And at the same time, someone who, when the conditions are right for peace and the Israeli public is ready for peace, to engage down that path and use his wisdom and use his name to do so.
No, that's good to know. And Alicia, you yourself today are involved in continuing your father's work, obviously, which has a definite Florida connection these days. Last year, as the chairman of the Elie Wiesel Foundation for Humanity, you announced that the University of South Florida and the Florida Holocaust Museum, both in St. Petersburg, would be the new home for your father's papers and artifacts. What led to that decision?
We're thrilled that the Florida Holocaust Museum is going to become the primary repository for all artifacts that, we as a family had to share after my father's passing. They're a tremendous crew. They are so dedicated to treating my father's legacy with respect and love, and they're thinking very carefully about how what sort of messages are we going to send? What kind of education are we going to offer? My father taught in the St. Petersburg area at Eckerd College for several decades, and we formed lasting friendships and relationships in the area.
Businessman and activist Elisha Wiesel is the son of the late renowned Holocaust survivor, author, and Nobel Peace Laureate Elie Wiesel. The new document, excuse me, the new documentary about his father's life, Elie Wiesel, Soul on Fire, will be shown next Friday at the Movies of Delray and Lake Worth, at the Gateway Cinema in Fort Lauderdale, and on November 3rd at the Miami Beach Bandshell. Elisha Wiesel, thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
Still to come, why this Sunday's Argentine election has American ramifications. This is the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. Welcome back to the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tim Padgett. So let me take you back to 2 years ago this month, October 2023. Donald Trump's road back to the White House still looks uncertain. In fact, he needs some political inspiration, and he gets it from an unlikely source, Argentina, a right-wing libertarian populist and a big Trump fan named Javier Milei wins the presidential election there. It's a shot in the arm for Trump, who immediately sends his congratulations on social media. The two become BFFs, which is why this Sunday's Argentine midterm elections matter. You see, Milei, despite his early success in reining in Argentina's runaway inflation and fiscal mess, needs a $20 billion bailout. Trump wants to give it to him, but under one condition. Argentines this weekend must vote for Milei's party, La Libertad Avanza. If it wins, they get the $20 billion. If not, no dice. Meanwhile, the idea of rescuing Argentina because Milei is Trump's buddy is coming under increasing scrutiny here in America. What do you think of the $20 billion Argentina deal? Call us at 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. Joining me now is one of our favorite Latin America analysts, Florida International University professor Eduardo Gamarra. Eduardo, always great to have you with us.
Thank you for having me, Tim. A pleasure to be here.
So remind our listeners just who Argentine President Javier Milei is, chainsaw and all, and why he and President Trump formed such a tight inter-American bond, shall we say, Eduardo.
Well, you might say that Milei is really the quintessential outsider, a university professor of economics, very, very heavily theoretical, writes books that, some say only he understands.
Yeah.
Used to be a very important, basically a columnist and a person who was always on the media giving an opinion of everything, including sexual matters for that matter.
Mm-hmm.
But from
a very libertarian perspective, right?
Of course.
Yeah.
But so he came in really from way out there, and his criticism, of course, of the Argentine development model, and especially his criticism of what he calls la casta, right? The traditional political parties, particularly the Peronist Party, but the Peronist Party, which largely has dominated Argentine politics for now the last years, and so. That model bred a lot of corruption, and most importantly, catapulted Argentina into its worst ever economic crisis. And
right.
And that's a lot to say, because Argentina has largely, been going from crisis to crisis, and continues to dig. And so Milei came in with this idea that his libertarian model could dramatically turn Argentina around, end inflation, and promote Argentine economic growth, and catapult Argentina back to greatness, so to speak.
And one of the things that has made Milei, the maverick, such a darling, not only of Trump, but of Republicans and the MAGA right here, is his crusade to return common sense economic orthodoxy back to Argentina after years of disastrously inflationary policies by the party he defeated there, as you mentioned, the Peronists. And to a large extent, Malay has been fairly successful in that effort, no? Especially when it comes to taming that inflation?
Yeah, I mean, in Argentina, inflation was the key thing worrying Argentines. And he largely took an economy that was on the verge of exploding into hyperinflation in a country that has had bouts of hyperinflation in the past. So Argentines deeply fear inflation. And he's largely been, over the last 18 months, has been able to control inflation and actually reduce it to the point where now it's, let's say, at a manageable state, even though it's still way above double digits, close to 30%.
Yeah.
But that's a long way from 400 or 500% where it was 2 years ago.
Definitely. But there have been problems, right? I mean, we've started to see cracks, not just in Milei's popularity, evidenced by recent local elections in Argentina where his party got thumped, but in his economic successes as well, right? What are some of the problems that are sort of, you know, bringing his popularity down right now?
Well, Tim, the reality is that, you know, economic austerity has to count on a very strong political base. And Milei does not have a strong political base. In fact, when you look at, you know, he barely had six senators, has six senators out of 72 and 37 members of the lower house out of a house of 257 deputies. So,
yeah.
So by and large, he needed to construct a very strong political base. And on top of that, he needed to do something for the vast majority of Argentines who have either lost their jobs or have lost a lot of the social safety net that was constructed.
Right. Which it's constructed to help bring down the inflation. But that brings us then to Argentina needing a $20 billion bailout from the U.S. Why do Milei and Argentina need this rescue, Eduardo?
Well, the reality is that over the course of the last year, and particularly in the current context, Argentina's future largely depends on an infusion, a huge infusion of money, of foreign money, let us say. Argentina has a very good relationship with China, curiously, and the Chinese have been willing to kind of bail out Argentina as well. But I think this is where the U.S. is in some measure playing a geopolitical card by saying, here's $20 billion in sort of a debt swap, pesos for dollars, will help you, you know, overcome this current moment of crisis right after the municipal elections that he lost, and will help you move forward. And in addition, Washington is saying, and if you win, there may be another $20 billion.
Right. And I want to get to that kind of quid pro quo. But first, there has been criticism, though, in the U.S. of Trump bailing out his buddy this way. And Trump has recently responded to criticism of his administration bailing out Argentina to the tune of $20 billion by, let's say, exaggerating a bit the economic crisis in that country. Here's a clip of what he said this week.
They're fighting for their life. Nothing's benefiting Argentina. They're fighting for their life. You understand what that means? They have no money. They have no anything. They're fighting so hard to survive.
He makes Argentina sound a bit like Somalia there, Eduardo. Are Argentines really fighting for their lives? I mean, what's the reality there that we should keep in mind as this $20 billion bailout process moves forward?
Yeah. I'm not one to say that the president doesn't exaggerate, but he may not be far from the truth, frankly.
Okay.
I think the situation in Argentina is dire. And reversing a course right now might, in fact, be catastrophic for Argentina. Mm-hmm. And Argentina is not a small economy. Argentina is a very big economy. And the social situation could get much worse without this kind of a bailout. And my sense, you know, that the administration is primarily fighting not just, you know, a geopolitical battle in Argentina, but it's also fighting local politics in the United States, as you know. I mean, farmers aren't too happy, primarily because Argentina also depends, its economy largely depends on the export of soybean to China, right?
Yeah.
And our own soybean farmers are not happy because, you know, all of a sudden the tariffs on China have really affected the soybean industry in the United States.
Yeah.
So, These are the kinds of trade-offs that I think both Argentina and the United States are facing today.
We have Juan Carlos from Miami on the line and has an Argentine connection himself. Juan Carlos, welcome to the South Florida Roundup. Hello, Juan.
Hi.
Hi.
How are you?
Fine. So what's on your mind?
So, you know, I just want to say that before Milei, they had this dual exchange. And, you know, basically, the prices in Argentina were down, like the prices of things when you were traveling as a tourist. Everything was sort of low price. And now Milei came into power. He, you know, completely got rid of the dual exchange rate, but now there's only one. But now everything is more expensive for Argentinians and obviously for tourists as well. And I just want to say, like, even the labor down there, it was, you know, we work with a lot with Argentinians abroad, and it was very good price before, and now the prices, everything, and people tell us down there everything is high, and before the inflation was bad, but now it seems like the new policies are not really working, you know, for Argentinians. Yeah. Or anybody.
Right. And it goes to what we were speaking about earlier. Juan Carlos, thank you very much. This is the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tim Padgett. I'm speaking with FIU's Eduardo Gamarra about this Sunday's Argentina midterm elections and the $20 billion bailout drama between President Trump and Argentine President Javier Milei that's hanging over them. Call us at 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. So now, Eduardo, we come to this Sunday's midterm elections in Argentina. And President Trump, as you mentioned earlier, recently made the rather stunning declaration that if President Milei's Libertad Avanza party doesn't come out on top at the polls this weekend, the U.S. will likely pull back on that $20 billion in assistance for Argentina. To a lot of people, that smacks a little bit like, I don't know, extortion to some of the critics. A U.S. president telling another country, vote for my buddy's party or America won't help you out. What should we make of that?
Well, I think that every time that the U.S. has intervened in an electoral setting, even in Argentina, you may recall that in the 1940s, when Perón was first running for office, mm-hmm. Ambassador Spradlin campaigned all over Argentina against Perón, and Perón won.
and we should note, this is not unusual for the U.S. to bail out a country, especially a Latin American country, in this fashion, no?
And remember, President Clinton also bailed out Argentina.
And Mexico, and et cetera.
And Brazil. And in Argentina, they used to talk about carnal relations, right, between Clinton and Menem. So this isn't the first. But I think that the administration, look, Milei needs between 35% and 40% to win a third of the vote and be able to at least maintain some kind of momentum going forward, mm-hmm. right? Most of the polls are saying that he's close.
Okay.
But here's the issue. At least this is my opinion more than sound analysis. It seems to me that the U.S. would be disingenuous of abandoning Argentina, even if Milei is not successful, because Milei will still be the president. He may be a lame duck, but for any kind of success in the next, what's left of Milei's term, Milei is going to need this international support.
Yeah.
And it might also, by the way, push Argentina, even under Milei, further and deeper into Chinese hands.
Right. In just the 30 seconds we have left, Eduardo, in the bigger picture, what does this Argentina bailout episode tell us about how President Trump deals with Latin America?
Well, as you know, we have a very unorthodox way of doing foreign policy lately. The president makes decisions sometimes without consulting even his closest advisors.
Yeah.
But in this case, I think it has to do with, in fact, a very close relationship with the business community, the Argentine business community, the Brazilian business community. There are very important brothers, Batista. Mm-hmm.
Well, we'll have to leave it there, Eduardo, but that's a great point to end on. Eduardo Gamarra is a political science and international relations professor at Florida International University. Eduardo, thanks as always.
Thank you, Tim.
Finally on the roundup, would you wear a Python purse, Python shoes, a Python wallet? The newest effort by the state to fight the most notorious invasive species in the Everglades is a partnership with a Miami-based leather products company called Inversa. That's out to turn pythons into Prada. It's a new incentive for hunters to remove those pythons, which have been devastating the Everglades and its native wildlife since the turn of the century. Henry Ferre is Inversa's head of development. He says in the 3 months since this public-private project began, the number of pythons removed from the Everglades has tripled.
The Everglades is an enormous asset to our economy in South Florida and Florida in the United States. The python are existentially threatening. Our goal is to help in that fight by reducing python and helping the taxpayer not front that cost.
Critics, though, say those market incentives might actually motivate illegal python breeding. But Inversa says they've taken measures like tracking hunters with GPS. That will do it for the South Florida Roundup. If you missed any part of the show, you can always search for the South Florida Roundup podcast in the NPR app or wherever you listen to podcasts. The show is produced by Jimena Romero with assistance from Denise Royal. Katie Munoz is our director of original live programming. Mateo Sanchez is digital director. Sergio Bustos is WLRN's vice president of news, the vice president of radio, and the show's technical supervisor is Peter J. Mertz. Richard Ives engineered today's show. I'm Tim Padgett. Have a great weekend, and thanks for listening. Gracias. Merci. Obrigado.
WLRN.